we talk about the justice side of this as well, he says that we're exaggerating. So that his emphasis clearly is on the police side. We have done something about strengthening law enforcement agencies, but we also recognize and have done something about the underlying social causes of unrest in keeping with the great tradition of Jefferson and the founders of this society.
Senator, isn't there a question of priorities between these two words, justice and order? Can we ensure the kind of justice and freedom of which you speak until we have an orderly society?
Well, Hitler tried the order side first, and he produced an explosion, not only in his country and in Europe, but in the world. We've managed to work toward both objectives from the beginning of our country. We didn't build a police state first. In 1787. I don't think America has ever been in a more chaotic, disrupted, confused condition than it was after the Revolution. 13 states who refused to work together, who erected tariff barriers against each other, created competing currencies, people restless under the declining economy of that period. You had rebellions up in Massachusetts, rebellions everywhere. And the answer of the founders was not to create a police state. The answer was to create a state in which people could achieve their full potential. Law enforcement agencies, yes. You can't have a vigilante society or a police state and create the kind of peace and harmony you need. And so you've got to work at both jobs. There's no reason why you can't. And incidentally, on this business of who's responsible for this whole business, you know, Mr. Nixon likes to say that because there was a national increase in the crime rate of 88% from 1960 to 1968, and there was a Democrat in the White House, that ergo, crime is a Democratic responsibility and a Democratic invention. This is his implication. What he doesn't tell us is that in that period, as always, law and order is a state and local responsibility. And if you look at the state and local records from 1960 to 1968, you get a different picture. In those states that had Republican governors throughout, the increase in crime was not 88%, but 170%. In those states that had Democratic governors throughout that period, the increase wasn't 88%, but 66%. Now, I don't use these figures to prove that crime is Republican in its nature, but I think it's legitimate to point out if I use Nixon's logic, that's the conclusion which I would urge. I mean, crime is a product of the conditions within which people live. We've known that from the beginning. The founders understood it from the beginning. They knew when societies became crowded, and people felt less significant, and found themselves in unacceptable living conditions, that you'd get disorder and protest that would erupt into violence. And they wanted to create the kind of society in which that wouldn't happen. And their conclusion was that the only hope was to build a society in which every member had an equal chance. When you have people limited by their environments, without jobs, without hope, we have broken families, not only in poor America, but in affluent America, you're going to have youngsters wandering off in directions without guidance, tempted by the temptations of an affluent society. When you have the correctional institutions, which incidentally are by and large under the jurisdiction of the states, develop more criminals than they do rehabilitate useful citizens, and that's the picture in this country, the statistics prove it, you're going to have a rise in crime. And we've got to get at those causes. We've got to have effective law enforcement agencies. We've got to have effective correctional institutions. We've got to deal with the narcotics traffic and the criminal problems that it creates. We've got to deal with organized crime. And here's another interesting story, incidentally. The Organized Crime Division of the Department of Justice in 1960 achieved 17 convictions in the last year of the Nixon Republican administration. In 1967, there were 688 convictions. So if you want to put a party label on this business, it doesn't make Republicans look good. But party labels have nothing to do with it. What we ought to be focusing on is not party labels or a change in party labels as a way of dealing with crime, but upon the causes. And they're multiple, because there are different kinds of crime. For example, half of the crimes against property are committed by kids under the age of 18. These aren't hardened criminals. How did they get that way? Well, they got that way because they came out of broken families, or they lived up in deteriorating environments and grew up in deteriorating environments where there were no recreational opportunities or chances to play or chances to improve themselves. This is why kids are turning to crime.
Questions now from William Street to the commercial appeal.
Senator Muskie, you touched in your speech today at the auditorium, and Governor Ellington and Senator Gore also mentioned this in their parts on the program. The recent upsurge of the Democratic ticket is reflected in the most recent polls. How do you account for this? What's made a big change in the last week or so?
Well, I think that, of course, when we came out of the National Convention in August, of course, we were in pretty complete disarray as a part of the division, and unorganized even apart from my division to conduct a national campaign. The convention date was set when I guess it was assumed that the president would be running for re-election. Well, to have a new nominee that close to election created problems in itself. Then there were the divisions generated by the convention and by the pre-convention controversy within the party. Those had to be healed. Next, because of our poor standing in the polls right after the convention, was how to get money. And so we started out with all these problems against us. Well, now we begin to put these things together. I think that's part of it. But secondly, I think in these last days, after voters have heard all of the discussion of the issues such as it has been, it hasn't been all of these as good as it should have been, they began to focus upon the man. Because they understand this year, I think, as perhaps all too rarely in the past, that there are no pat answers to a lot of these problems, especially those at home. Even war, although a lot of people suggest pat answers to that one. So they're focusing on the man, and they recognize that what they're looking for is a man they can trust to lead them in dealing with these problems. So they're looking at the qualities of the men. And I think as they look at them, and they see in George Wallace a man who proposes to govern by playing on the fears of the country, its suspicions, stimulating the hatreds that underlie the surface of too much of our life, the doctrine of division. They look at Mr. Nixon, and here's a man who hasn't used this campaign as a way of building a mandate for himself. He decided that there's a tide of protest big enough that he could win simply by riding that tide, an essentially negative campaign that contributes nothing to public enlightenment on these issues. Oh, I know he's issued position papers that give a little attention and makes a few radio speeches, but his activities which are highlighted, the ones that get television coverage in the big cities before great crowds, he doesn't talk about these issues. Negative campaign. Only candidate who's talking to the people about these issues is Hubert Humphrey. Then there's the quality of the men. I mean, are they the kind of people that you trust with this kind of leadership? And I think as people focus upon the real choice of the men, they're reassessing Hubert Humphrey and more turning to him. Now, Nixon, of course, is coasting. It's pretty hard to be coasting for 8 weeks and then sprint. He's in trouble. He's got to win with what he's got. But the vice president is climbing. He's generating momentum. The interesting question is whether his line is going to cross Mr. Nixon's by November 5th. That's going to be the interesting question in these last days.
Your assessment then is that Nixon is probably holding what he's got, that Humphrey is climbing, and that the votes that Humphrey is gaining are either coming from the Wallace camp or from the great mass of undecided voters. Do you think Humphrey?
I think he's also getting some from the Nixon camp, because the Nixon kind of campaign doesn't deepen the commitment of his supporters. You know, it's a very thin commitment, and that commitment can disappear in these last few days. I know, for instance, in my state, There's this feeling, for example, that among a lot of Republicans in my state, that they can vote for Mr. Nixon and for me. Well, as their attention is focused on the fact that this isn't possible, they're taking another look at Mr. Humphrey. And it's going to be very, very interesting. The polls don't show the depth of commitment. There's no way of doing it. Moreover, they don't show the impact of the ticket. They pit Mr. Humphrey against Mr. Nixon against Wallace. They never poll Humphrey, Muskie against Nixon, Agnew against Wallace LeMay. That's a factor we haven't had measured. We also don't know what percentage of each man's supporters are going to turn out and vote. Well, Nixon's campaign hasn't been the kind of stimulating enthusiasm among his followers. I think he made a very serious mistake when he started out on this kind of a campaign, and I hope that's proven.
Well, the most recent addition to the vice presidential candidate ranks, of course, is General LeMay. Do you feel that he made his selection as a running mate for Wallace made any impact on the Wallace campaign one way or the other?
Well, at times it appears to have made Mr. Wallace unhappy.
We've also heard a great deal of discussion about what the voters consider the major issue in this campaign, domestic discord, the war in Vietnam. What, in your opinion, from what you've seen and heard in your travels, is the number one issue of the American people?
Well, I put it this way. This is not evasive. It's really the way I feel about it. I think the thing that has disturbed Americans most in the last two or three years is the fear that we've lost in this country, or that we may have lost in this country, the relationship of trust among American people. You know, not that we were ever perfect, or not, you know, that we were saints, but we understood, I think, quietly, implicitly, that in order to make this kind of society work, you had to have trust. And as you've seen all the stories in recent years of the refusal of a neighbor to come to the assistance of a neighbor being attacked, for example, the increasing reluctance of people to become involved, and as people see the violence in the streets and the demonstrations or the protests of disadvantaged people whose grievances they don't understand, you get to feel that, well, this underlying trust, basis of trust, may have been destroyed. And if it has, America tomorrow is going to be something far different than it was yesterday. So now, I think they've got to decide whether or not they're willing to keep working on this question of trust among Americans. Because it underlies the law and order. It underlies the question of race relations. It underlies the question of governing our cities and rebuilding. It underlies the question of mobilizing the resources of metropolitan areas, both suburban and the central city, to deal with the people problems of those great areas. Indeed, it even underlies the watershed.
Questions now from Noel Adams of Memphis Press Center.
Senator Muskie, Memphis is the largest city using TVA power. What is your position on the Tennessee Valley Authority?
I've always said, I think that this kind of resource development is part of our great growth as a country. My regret has been that we in New England haven't benefited from similar developments. We've tried in the last two Congresses to get, we've gotten authorized, but we haven't got appropriate funding for great hydroelectric development on the St. John River in Maine. We've never had a public power project in New England. As you know, we have some of the highest power costs in the country. And so I've been for TVA because, well, we have an expression in New England, the rising tide lifts all the boats. And as we develop each region of the country, we add to our total national strength and it benefits us all.
Well, how do you feel the Democrats are doing now in the South, the Democratic National Committee, and the Democratic National Ticket?
Well, we get what we would have regarded a few weeks ago as surprising evidence of favorable response. I was in Texas yesterday and this morning, and I must say the response was fantastic. My first speech, this campaign, was in Texas. At that point, I was an unknown lawyer from Maine, and I got the typical Southern hospitality, but they still didn't know me, you see, and didn't really respond. But yesterday in Amarillo, Abilene, Wichita Falls, and this morning in Tyler City, the crowds were just fantastic, not only in their numbers, but in their response. So I think that we may do much better in at least some parts of the South than we thought perhaps we might 8 weeks ago.
Well, let me ask you, why didn't the vice president come to Memphis as President Johnson did in 1964 and as President Kennedy did in 1960?
Well, I think it's only a question of scheduling and the impossibility of being everywhere we'd like to be. There are other places I'd like to go to and want to go to that I can't because of the time limitations. That's all a product of that late convention, though. It's been very difficult. I'd like to have gone to Alaska, for example, because... you know, if the election goes to the House of Representatives, Alaska's vote is equal to Texas' vote.
Well, now you've been jet-stopping all over the country and speaking to crowds. Do you ever sit down and just talk to some average voter? And if so, what do you find the main thing is on his mind? What is the number one thing on the mind of the average voter today?
Well, I think that if you talk to young people, the thing on their minds is the war, mostly. Or they're also concerned about their right to get involved in this political process, the war. If you talk to older Americans, I think what is described as the law and order issue, but which I think, and I try to suggest today, is much broader than that, involving the whole question of the relationship of people to each other in our society, is the greatest motivating force. But thirdly, I think now the issue is the man in these closing days. Not that the others have disappeared. They're still very much a factor. But I think in these closing days, the issue is the man.
A week ago today on the same program, Governor Agnew said that he thought there was very similar qualifications for the office of vice president that existed between himself and you. Now, how do you feel about that question?
Well, I feel very inadequate to the job.
Well, he pointed out that...
I don't know whether he intended to make that point.
He felt there was a lot of similarity between the two candidates.
Well, I think the year after I'd been elected governor, we had similar backgrounds. And I since then, 10 years ago. But it's not for me to evaluate the comparative merits of the vice presidential candidates. I'd rather say what I'm for and what I stand for and let people judge for themselves.
Well, right quickly then, how did you like the reception you received in Memphis today?
Oh, it's as warm-hearted and enthusiastic. It was great. It's earlier this campaign when I was here in Nashville and less known then, it's hard to distinguish now between the traditional Southern hospitality and the campaign enthusiasm.
I couldn't help but notice that you had all the various elements of the Democratic Party on the stage with you today, and that's the first time that's happened in my four years.
That's a real good clue. You know, in every state now, we find local candidates beginning to run on the ticket.
Gentlemen, we have about 1 minute. Final question from Norman Burr.
Senator, this may be unfair in a minute, but it's apparent that if you win, or whoever wins, it will be with something substantially below a popular majority. Isn't that going to make it difficult to govern effectively if people divide it so ideologically and politically?
It will be difficult, because two other presidents have been elected with less than the popular majority, Truman and Kennedy, although I suspect their percentage is higher than the winner of this
much
year
will be.
It's a question of what kind of leadership is exerted. I mean, presidents with minority support have become leaders because they've exerted the leadership qualities that they have to unite the country and to heal it. It can be done. It'll be difficult. It would be much better. Although I'm not always sure about that. President Johnson had an overwhelming popular majority, and yet in the last months of his presidency, he's had problems. President Kennedy had less than a majority, and when he was unfortunately taken away, he had considerable public support. It's all a question of how events develop, the kind of leadership the president exerts, and the breaks the president gives. So President Johnson's had some tough breaks in his administration.
Senator, I hate to interrupt, but our time is gone. Thank you, Senator Muskie, for being with us today on Pulse.
This year, your campaign to vice president would be the most expensive president in history. In 1960, he said a man could put to the fore, John Kennedy. This year, he says America can't afford human hunger. In 1960, he said that John Kennedy would need two or three magic wands to conjure up an increase of $85 billion in our national production. This year, he's dropped the number of magic wands to one, but still insists that the vice president will need keep America's economy expanding. In 1960s, Nixon went around the country referring to John Kennedy as a medicine man. He said, I can think of no carnival confidence man selling a worse class medicine to an unsuspecting customer. He described it as the best medicine show that ever came to town. Well, it was part of the medicine show. But in fact, it wasn't bad medicine. For an alien economy, which under the Nixon Republican prescription had suffered three recessions, had suffered the greatest number of business failures since the Depression, cost us $175 billion in lost production, and it put 3 million additional Americans out of work. Since switching to the Kennedy remedy, the Kennedy medicine, the nation has enjoyed 92 months of unparalleled growth and prosperity. Our national production has risen, not by the $85 billion, which Mr. Nixon suggested was impossible, but by over $370 billion in this fiscal year. What has that made possible? It has made possible more jobs, better paying jobs, better standing of life for individual Americans. But more than that, it has increased our capacity to deal with the public business. As a result of this great surge in national economic strength, we've been able to double our annual investment in education from $26 billion to $52 billion this year. Because of that great strength, we've been able to double our investment in health facilities for the benefit of those unable to provide for themselves. More than that, we've been able to double our annual investment in new industries, new manufacturing plants, with all that means is tens of jobs and opportunities, not only for Americans who already enjoy it, but for those who did not. And we've done this at a lesser cost for the individual taxpayer. Corporations and individuals this year will pay $16 billion less in taxes than they would be paying if the 1960 tax rates still prevailed, even with the temporary tax surcharge of this year. This year, even after the income tax surcharge, American families are paying hundreds of dollars less in income taxes than in the last Nixon Republican year. A family with $5,000 income pays $130 less. A family with $10,000 income pays $174 less. A family with $15,000 income pays $269 less. There are other things Mr. Nixon fails to mention about the Democratic and Republican medicine, such as employment, which has increased by more than 10 million jobs since 1961, or 2.5 times that of the Nixon Republican years. or unemployment. Put your decline in 70% of the workforce in early 1961 to 3.5% today. The lowest level in 50 years. If the rate is still where the Republicans have left, in 1960, more than 3 million people now holding jobs would be unemployed. Consider what we've done in these past 8 years. Since 1960, the spendable income of the average American has increased by 32%. Since 1960, unemployment has declined by 41%. Home ownership has risen by 12%. And 13 million Americans have moved out of poverty. Since 1960, after allowing for price increases, the number of families with incomes of $10,000 or more increased from 7.5 million to 14 million. And Kentucky shares in the nation's prosperity. Personal income from this state rose $2.8 billion annually over what it was in 1960. Per capita income for Kentucky families was $813 more than in 1960. The average weekly industrial paycheck is $32.42 more than it was in 1960. But this hasn't happened accidentally. And you know, Mr. Nixon described in his public appearances, which I have defined for you here tonight, as the period of the greatest progress and the greatest prosperity in the history of the country. The policies that Jack Kennedy advocated in 1960, he described as bad medicine to the country. But I think in the next 4 years, we need more of that kind of medicine. In 1960, he lost his election because he was a baby, John Kennedy. In 1968, he will lose an election because he refused to debate. Thank you. Vice President and I don't deny that the government must invest, and the country must invest, to build a stronger American society, which will truly be a place of opportunity for every American. What Mr. Nixon and his advisors don't seem to understand is that you don't save money by doing nothing. In fact, when you don't invest, you ensure that when the job finally gets done, it costs more. The high cost of doing nothing gets higher all the time. How, for example, do you measure the costs of building classrooms in the 60s that should have been built in the Republican 50s? How do you measure the cost of flood debt because a dam wasn't built? How do you measure the cost of supporting the welfare cases because an administration refused to support training and job opportunity programs? How do you measure the cost of juvenile delinquency and slums, which have not been replaced by decent houses and effective community development programs? How do you measure the cost of families, of men who care for their aged parents, because the administration refused to support Medicaid? And not all of the cost is measured in dollars and cents. Some of it is measured in human suffering, in loss of dignity and hope, in the loss of natural resources and natural beauty. How do you measure the cost of 12 million children who go to bed hungry each night because of the administration's indifference? How do you measure the cost of preventing 35% of our brightest high school students from going on to college in the Nixon Republican years? How do you measure the cost of seeing a family fall apart because of low pay or no job at all? How do you measure the cost of pollution of our lakes, streams, rivers, and our air? Or the cost of land erosion and ravaged forests? These are costs that never entered into Mr. Nixon's calculation. They are the kind of costs that this country indicated it was prepared to assume when this great experiment in American democracy began in 1787, because it was the objective then, as it is now, to create a society in which every individual can have a stake. President Washington, in his first address to his first Congress, pointed out to the Congress its responsibility to promote the education of the country's children. It wasn't until the 1960s, under Democratic President Thomas, that the first general education bill was enacted. Those who created this country, those who founded this governmental system, were undertaking to build a country. And they understood that to build it required more than bricks and mortar or machinery. But to build a country, you have to build it out of what is existing. That can be stimulating the growth of whatever is inside the individual human being, the mind, the heart, the spirit, the skills, the talents, the creative energy of an unleashed human being in a free society. This is what we undertook to do at the beginning. Obviously, we didn't achieve it overnight, but we've made great progress toward that objective.
greater than any society in time since man has ever lived. And why did the fathers undertake it to do it this way? But Jefferson, I think, put it better than anybody. He says you can't have law and order, and he used that phrase at the time I was at. You can't have law and order unless you have a society in which every member of it is a state. He says you can't build law and order based upon ignorance, images, and oppression. Your study of this issue. But those who wrote the Constitution, Jefferson, Madison, Franklin, Washington, that whole great host were made up of men who knew the history of man, who had studied it, who understood the various systems of government which had been tried, who man's agonized history. Create societies in which human beings could live at home. They knew that repression wasn't the way to do it. They knew that building walls between the affluent and the poor wasn't the way to do it. They were convinced there was only one way to do it. To build a free society, one another, which every creature could aspire to whatever greatness God had given it. Well, they had doubts about the future. Jefferson, you know, was a great believer in the agrarian society. The reason he was is because he feared what would happen when America became crowded and urbanized and industrialized. He knew, because man's history is replete with examples, that when that happened, the individual would feel less significant and indeed would be less significant. Less able to shape the forces which determine the direction of his own life. Less able to influence the public policy, which shaped his life. So Jefferson wondered whether when America reached that point of its desire, the system of government that he and his colleagues created would meet the test. For the time he feared is with us. It is here. We've got to deal with the problem. And we've got to answer the same question that they answered. You solve this problem by dividing America, or you solve it by uniting America. I think the American answer has been so well documented and proven in our 180 years that it's worth trying in the years ahead, as we have in the years that have passed. That is threatened this year as never before, with the possible exception of the Civil War. And that is the question of the basis upon which individual Americans are willing to live with each other. Because you can't create freedom by enacting a law in Washington. You can't create harm by enacting law. The answer to the unrest in our society rests more with each and you individually than with anyone who is elected on November 3rd. Because freedom this isn't to say that those who elect can default on their responsibility to assume leadership and to establish the guidelines and the rules under which freedom can prosper. But the relationship in the free society between man and man, woman and woman, has to be one of trust or of hard words. And I mean the kind of trust that's willing to take a chance on the other side. Because if you just trust safe people, you aren't trusted. You've got to be willing to trust people who may prove to be weak. You've got to be willing to trust people who may prove to be weak. Or who, in the blindness of their complaints against his justice, may strike out against friends as well as enemies. That's what I mean by trust. You've got to be willing to trust someone who lives 3,000 miles away, who may be of a different color, different background entirely, different tastes and personality. But you've got to be willing to trust him. How else can you build a free society set on the basis of trust? And if the people can't trust each other, how can they trust their leaders? And if they can't trust their leaders, how can their leaders trust their men? This is the glue of a free society: mutual trust. It's not going to be easy to develop, because Americans are fearful of each other. They are distrustful of each other. They are suspicious of each other and each other's motives. And I think the really single most important thing that is troubling most Americans, whether they are black or white, or whatever their national origin or their religion, is the fear that somehow we moved from a time when, despite their shortcomings, there was a basic willingness among Americans to trust each other, to another time, a more fearful time, of permanent division and fear of hatred here in America. That's what's troubling people. It's described as the law and order issue, or as the racial issue, or as the city problem. But it really is the fear on the part of too many Americans, every segment of our society, that it isn't going to be safe to trust other Americans tomorrow as it has been in the past. That's the question of this election year. I say it's still safe. I say it's still worth taking a chance. And I say finally that there's no other choice. And the history of man tells us there's no other choice. Because once a society loses this capacity to work together, what then happens has been so well described by the Durans in their latest book. The affluent become more affluent. The poor become more poor. Work together, build together. The only country in America that has ever made any sense. Senator for 10 years, whom I acknowledge I give you is a man for 10 years. And on the basis of a quarter of a century of record in public life, I know this is the kind of America he wants to help build in the years to come. And by building in that way as created here on this planet, the greatest force of potential good for the average American and for all mankind that has ever been permitted to assemble within the borders of a single country. This is what you young people have to work with. We don't have problems this year. We have jobs to do. Jobs to do. Big, important, serious jobs. But the kind of jobs Americans have displayed a peculiar genius for getting done under the right leadership. And these are the jobs we're going to begin doing with your help.